Here we go. Question number one. Dear High Ajahn Brahm, does a Sotapanna need to attain jhana? How about Sakadagami or Anagami? Do they need to attain jhanas? Sotapanna. There are two types of Sotapannas. One who's on the path of being a stream winner, and one who's actually attained the Sotapanna. The second one is an experience. Because what made me study the study Pali was that no one seemed to know much about how the Buddha explained the Vinaya, that's the monks' rules and nuns' rules as well, when I became a monk. And studying Pali was very close to studying Latin. And I remember doing Latin at school. And I remember just, many people don't like those type of languages, but I didn't mind them. Because I remember on one of the school desks at the school I attended, someone had carved in onto the lid of the school desk, "Latin is a language as dead could be. First it killed the Romans, now it's killing me." I never forget that. But nevertheless, I learned it. And it helps. I found a use for it because it's so close to Pali. So there's two types of ones who actually on the path of being a stream winner, and one who's actually attained that that wisdom. And if someone comes along, if they're a monk or a nun, and they say they're a stream winner, we've got to investigate to see whether it's true or not. And one way we can find out, we ask them, when did it happen? Where did it happen? Because a stream winner is an event. If you're on the path of being a stream winner, that can happen many, many times. So not, sorry, that's not the right way of saying it. Please delete that. That becoming on the path of being a stream winner, that can just sort of grow on you. Not an event, but just a gradual understanding. But the real seeing of what the Buddha saw of anatta and dukkha and anicca, that is an experience. So for that, yes, you do need a jhana to be able to see the fruit of being a stream winner. And Sakadagami, Anagami, of course, yes, as well. The Anagami, it said, there's no way you can even know what blocks you. What's this one?
Green tea.
Green tea. For throat. Thank you. He didn't see my expression afterwards, sorry. Because green tea, I usually have black tea. But I've had so much black tea, I don't need any more. Well, thank you very much. Your compassion is wonderful. So, an anagami, it said specifically, you cannot get to being an anagami without jhanas. No more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. That was one of the Buddha's similes. And as soon as I heard that, I don't know if you're rebellious like I am, surely there must be another way. And I started to think and just fantasize, and say, how can I get to the heartwood of a tree? Maybe just go through the end of the root and just go up. But no, it's you need the jhanas for that. And if you've experienced those jhanas, you know why. Eightfold Path. What's the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path? Jhanas. Always said that. Consistent throughout the whole of the Sutta Pitaka. Sammasamadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is what? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. So that's why that's necessary. Otherwise, the Buddha has said the way to get a jhana is the Sevenfold Path. There's not a Sevenfold Path, it has to be the Eightfold Path. Anyway, hi Ajahn, I have committed the same crime for a few times years back. How can I manage the guilt, shame and regret? It is very difficult for me to move forward, especially the shame. Thank you. You're wondering what I'm wondering, what he did. Or she did, I didn't say he. Maybe they are a serial killer. Please lock your rooms tonight. P.S. I heard many in the group are having similar problems. We've got many serial killers. Can you show us a meditation on how to be kind to our past and let go of the baggage so we can move on? Thank you. I don't know about a meditation, but just the idea, why do people hold on to the past sometimes? Was that you? It was wonderful to be able to go into those prisons where people had done some very bad, serious crimes in the past. But that was in the past, for goodness sake. Just because you do a bad act when you were young doesn't make you a criminal for the whole of your existence, does it? We all make mistakes sometimes. How many mistakes have you made? Is there anyone here who's never made a mistake? So I was looking at you, Wassy. Have you ever made a mistake?
Sure.
Sure, okay. So sometimes those mistakes. One of the mistakes I made, because I remember, you may not believe this, but when I was young, I had a motorbike. I had big, bushy hair, and where the hair stopped, a beard. And a motorbike, vroom, vroom, vroom. I remember one day just going down Notting Hill Gate, you know, the hill from Notting Hill. That's why it's called Notting Hill, because there's a hill there. And going down the hill towards Shepherd's Bush. You didn't know that, did you, that I was actually born in a bush? Shepherd's Bush in London. But anyhow... going down the hill, it was rainy, wet, which is common in the UK. And somebody stepped out on the pedestrian crossing. The car in front of me slammed on the brakes. I was behind that car, so I slammed on my brakes as well on the motorbike. It was only going 30 miles an hour. It's not fast. And then there must have been some oil on the road because you go into a skid. And I was just out of control, heading towards the back of this car. And you had one of these moments, you had these choices. There's a pedestrian on the pedestrian crossing there somewhere. I don't know where he was, I couldn't see because I was behind the car. I had a choice, because, you know, the brakes, you know, there's no way I could stop, would actually slam into the back of the car or swerve around the car and just hope for the best that I would miss the pedestrian. No, now I don't know why I made that decision to swerve around. Unfortunately, I missed a pedestrian. But that was luck. I got out of a difficult situation. But, you know, if I swerved around and hit that pedestrian, I'd probably be in prison. Wouldn't be a monk. It's just one of those split-second decisions you make. And that's afterwards. I remember just parking by the side of the road and then really started sweating. This was very fortunate. But anyway, some people aren't so fortunate. So sometimes they do go to jail. Sometimes when people say there, but by good fortune go you or I, there's a lot of truth to that. So sometimes, you know, that when we don't judge ourselves, you made a mistake, or you weren't so lucky as an Ajahn Brahm. So please, forgive yourself. You learn from the mistakes. You never, ever want to punish yourself. I don't know what crimes you've done, but let them go, for goodness sake. All you need to do is to learn from them. If you learn from them, if you have shame about them, you can't talk about it to anybody, so you can't relax with it, let it go. You're an imperfect human being. All those stories I've said, all the damage which is on the trees in this forest. Oh, that actually reminds me. There's a tree in this forest, I think, on the walking path, the path number 3, isn't it? Path A.
okay, there's a tree in this forest, and we've cornered it off, because I think today, in the last 24 hours, a big branch fell from it. So it's really dangerous. It's cordoned off to protect you from any injury. So please don't go and think, oh, it's cordoned off, what the heck, I'm going underneath that. Because if you get knocked on the head by a big branch from that tree, that's the end of you. And, you know, okay, you're free choice, but we have to ring up the police and the ambulance and goodness knows what else. And I don't know. Who will go to jail? I suppose that would be Nolia. Or Robin. Yeah, you will be off duty when you go to jail. But anyway, just to look after yourselves. So you see the tree cordoned off on path number A. That's, you know, just walking path for exercise. Please don't go underneath it. It's a dangerous tree. So where was I going? Oh, the trees. All the trees in the forest are all imperfect. Do any of the trees feel guilty and ashamed of being imperfect? Go and ask one of the trees. You should be ashamed of yourself, tree. You know, you dropped a branch which really scared us and it could kill us, and now we can't go walking on our favourite path. Naughty tree, never do that again, tree. Shame on you. Only humans feel shame. It's okay to do it, maybe be ashamed just for half an hour, just to remind yourself this is not what should have been done, but not for the whole of your life, for goodness sake. Please let it go. And anyway, just, you did a stupid act, why did you do that? And sometimes you can't really judge yourself. Why? That's beyond, beyond certainty. So because of that, please let it go. And if you really want to understand why you got Angulimala, he really was a serial killer. There must be something about Buddhist meditators, they're serial killers. Well, you said you did. You're not a serial killer. I don't know what crime you've done, probably hardly anything at all. But anyway, whatever it was, just don't do it again. That's all. Shame does not help. Shame, you never feel good enough. You don't feel worth it. I know when people have addictions to drugs or to pornography or to alcohol, whatever that addiction is, they feel that just they're hopeless, they're just a defective human being, so they don't belong anywhere. And so they don't even think they should, you know, they deserve to be forgiven. But of course everyone does. And Angulimala kills so many human beings. He really was a murderer. And when the Buddha saw him, the Buddha just said, stop. Stop. Stop worrying about that past. Let it go. Stop living in the past. Stop worrying about the future. Stop. Be still. He became an enlightened being. An arahat. And he liked to tell that story because I don't know what crimes you have done and you feel guilt and shame about that. I'm sure it wasn't as bad as Angulimala. And the Buddha allowed Angulimala to become a monk. He allowed him to, well, not allowed him, but Angulimala became an enlightened being. So there's no barriers for you, whoever said this, that he did a crime a few times years back. It's years back, it's past. Let it go. Dear Ajahn, are dreams defilements manifesting themselves? They can be. But you know, there are sometimes there are dreams which are predictions of the future. Remember that story? Here it comes again. Of that man here in Perth who had this dream early in the morning, and the dream with his five angels. And the five angels were lined up, and every angel had five pots of gold, gold coins. And each angel gave this man in a dream 5 pots of gold coins each. That's 25 pots of gold coins worth a fortune. I know some of you heard that story before, but I've heard it more times than you have. Every time I tell it. So 25 pots of gold coins in this dream. And you know what usually happens? When you receive the last beautiful good thing, that's when you wake up. So he woke up, turned on the light in his bedroom. There was no angels in the room. He wasn't really so concerned about that, but he was looking around for the gold coins. There was none of them either. It was just a dream. So he went downstairs. His wife had already gone off to work. And his wife that morning had made him 5 pieces of toast and 5 boiled eggs. He's wondering, what's with this magic number 5? And he just looked at the newspaper. The 5th of May. 5th day of the 5th month. And he looked in the back of the newspaper. Horse racing. There's a horse racing course here in Perth called Ascot, named after the famous one in UK. A-S-C-O-T. 5 letters. It was like somebody was trying to tell him something. 5 angels, 5 things of gold. 5th of May, 5 eggs, 5 pieces of toast. Ascot, 5th of May. So he looked at the 5th race at Ascot that afternoon, and he could not believe his eyes when he saw horse number 5. In race number 5 that afternoon, it was called 5 Angels. A horse by that name was running that afternoon. I thought, wow, this is can't be coincidence. So his wife had already gone out to work, so he didn't tell his wife. He took the afternoon off work. He went to the bank first of all to keep the lucky number 5. He drew $5,000 out of his bank account. And he went to the racetrack. He chose the 5th bookmaker in line. And he put $5,000 to win. Horse number 5, race number 5, 5 angels. The lucky number 5 could not be wrong. The lucky number 5 wasn't wrong. His horse came in 5th. So that's what happens with dreams. Yeah, they can be telling you something, but you don't understand what they mean. That's the trouble. So most dreams are defilements manifesting themselves. No, they're pretty meaningless dreams, so I wouldn't really worry too much about them either way. They're not defilements. But what happens is when you're meditating, your mind becomes more powerful. And somebody says, like, things get amplified in your dreams. They're more clear. And if you have a beautiful day, then those dreams are pretty beautiful. If you get a bit sort of unhappy, then those dreams become unhappy. It's like an amplification of, you know, the remainder of the day's mind states. Dear Ajahn, what is the cause of mindfulness increasing? There's a couple of causes. I already mentioned one of those was stillness. When you're really still, mindfulness really gets strong. What the Buddha said, this is when 5 hindrances start to be reduced, get weaker and weaker. Then these are hindrances to mindfulness, as well as to stillness, as well as to wisdom. But what I like to notice, there are hindrances to mindfulness. So when those 5 hindrances are strong, you are restless, sloth and torpor, even wanting something. When you want something, you're not aware of what you have right now. That old saying, when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. So if you want to get some joy and happiness, that joy coming up in your meditation, wherever you are in this the stages of meditation. If you want something more, you're not enjoying this, you can't really appreciate the joy you have already. So please, wanting destroys mindfulness. You're not here, you're where you want to go. The same, like, ill will is another form of wanting. But more also, as I always mention this when we do any ordination for somebody, it's a little phrase which I have to chant with, even when you ordain the bhikkhunis. Remember, I didn't ordain, but when you sort of, what's it called, you confirm the ordination with the monk Sangha. And then because I'm the senior monk in these ceremonies, I have to do this chanting afterwards, the four things not to be done, the four things to be your, what's it called, your supports for the rest of your life, and also just the nice things about why you're becoming a bhikkhuni or a bhikkhu. And there you start saying, Silang Paribhavito Samadhi Mahapalo Hoti Mahani Sangso. Did I say that right? Yeah. When your meditation is supported by virtue, it's of great power and great benefit. And that's what I said to each one of you, because I was there at your ordinations, and yours as well. And this is powerful. When your meditation is supported by your virtuous conduct, it's of great power. And that's the same with mindfulness increasing. Can you keep precepts? Not because you're a goody-goody, but because why break anything? It just makes you more aware, more peaceful, less hindered. So that's one of the reasons why we have virtue. And the virtue gets more refined when you have what we call the sense restraint. That's the, you know, the next level of virtuous conduct. It's not that you're doing something evil when you start to, you know, look at something you really want but can't afford. But nevertheless, if you have that sense restraint, your mindfulness gets really, really strong. And it's fun to have strong mindfulness. Joy, have a wonderful time. Hi Ajahn, how easy is it to enter jhana after you enter it once? Well, once you enter it once, you're in it, so you can't enter it again, because you're already there. No, it's easier for one reason, is you're not scared of it anymore. You may hear it, and you may sort of hear monks like me saying how gorgeous it is, how wonderful it is. And I do that for a reason, but I also say how safe it is. You've got nothing to worry about. Because sometimes it's just so powerful. And it's like, you know, you're just watching it. You can go in easy. It's, doors are open to these jhanas. And sometimes people say, oh, it's a bit much for me. Oh. There was this, the nun's not here, but there was many years ago, there was a 10-precept nun staying at Bodhinyana Monastery for the rains retreat. She was really getting some good meditation. She was on the edge of jhana. And so I allowed her just to, no, please, come any time, every day, to get an interview, because when you're so close, it's much better to talk about, you know, how to get through that last hurdle to jhanas, rather than talking about the problems with your wife, the problems with your son or your business or some of this other stuff which people talk about, which I know nothing about, but I give an opinion anyway. But anyhow, so she was really close to getting these jhanas. And I just couldn't understand why she wasn't just entering them. And then one day she told me, I think she just found out herself. You know what she said? She said, I've discovered the reason why I can't enter the jhana, even though it's so close to me, because I don't think I deserve it. And that made me so sad. She had this bit of guilt or shame. I don't know from where, the way she was brought up, the way, you know, maybe women have that from your mothers, you know, you're not as good as anybody else, you don't deserve anything, you're not treated with such respect. And I just thought, I felt so sad. Now, all she needed to do was to feel, yes, yeah, she's good enough, she does deserve it, she can, why not? But it doesn't matter how many times I said, you do deserve it. I just, she couldn't break through. It was just right in front of her. But she couldn't do it. So please, you all deserve jhanas. You all can experience the jhanas. You all, if Angulimala can, you can. You don't need to be super intelligent. You don't even need to keep your... I shouldn't say this, but... I'm being honest with you. You don't have to keep your precepts perfectly, as long as it's kind of good enough. Good enough. How much good is good enough? So you can forgive yourself, let go of any lapses. That's why that even when you see these nimittas, sometimes you see these nimittas... The way I told it to in a talk in Malaysia many years ago, I remember this because my attendant at the time, one of the lay people, he came out to me afterwards. He said, I have this problem too. I told him that sometimes you see a nimitta, like a beautiful light, you know, it's gorgeous, but it's got splodges in it. It's not perfect. And it's a kind of a dirty, a stained nimitta. And this guy came up and said, that's what I just had. And I said, the reason for that is because you haven't been keeping your precepts. He said, yes, I'm sorry, Ajahn Brahm. He didn't tell me what he'd done, but he felt really guilty. He had a splodgy nimitta. So if you have a splodgy nimitta, the trick, the loophole, the way to get around that, obviously the best way of getting around that, keep your precepts next time, okay? But if you don't, in that splodgy nimitta, there's always one part of it which is clean and beautiful and perfect and unsplodged. And you focus on that, zoom in on that, and you get past, you know, the splodges. And you can get into beautiful nimittas, even though you're not perfect sila. It's more, just a little bit more difficult, but you can do that. So, please... try and keep your precepts. If you break them, just tell somebody and just resolve not to do it ever again, and that's fine. But if you do get the splodgy nimitta, just go to the... It's always a part of it which is more beautiful than the other part. And anyway, if you enter jhana after you've entered it once, the first time you've entered it, you know it, what it's like, and it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. So that means you're not afraid. You know you deserve it. You've done it once, you can do it again. But the problem with it, the difficulty with it, it's so nice, so beautiful. And it's common. I don't see how anyone could not do this. You want to re-experience it. I know this one monk, you know, he got some got a jhana when he was young, so the lay people, later on he became a monk. It took him years to get those jhanas back. Not that long, a few years. Reason was, because he wanted it. And once you know what's going to happen, you see the jhana almost in front of you, yeah, you get excited. And it's hard to quell that excitement when you know what's going to happen afterwards. Bliss out. So remember, don't want these things. That's a hindrance. Don't want it. Just want the causes for jhanas. And that was a trick. You know, once you realize the causes of what you're aspiring for, you get those causes strong, you're mindful, you're at peace, you're still, you're just happy to be here, content and easily satisfied, not proud or demanding in nature. Where did I hear that recently? It's in the chart we do. And if you can cultivate that, you're cultivating the causes. It's just like whoever's working in the kitchen. You see all the dirty dishes and you say, oh, when are those dishes going to be clean? I want those dishes to be clean. I really want those dishes to be clean. Will those dishes become clean that way? The wise person, they forget about wanting the dishes to be clean, they just put them in the dishwasher and they become clean all by themselves. That's like jhanas. Instead of I want jhana, you just let go, put the causes in place, and then the jhana happens. Want the causes, not the results.
Okay.
What does Atta Samapaniditha in the Mangala Sutta say? What is that phrase? It's when it's taken out of context, I want to know the rest of the verse. Venerable? I'm trying to figure out where it fits in. But I think it's... Okay. So what does it actually mean? I think it means almost like a right aspirations, panida. And I don't know if it's atta or atta, T-T-H-A. Okay, I'll answer that tomorrow. I'll go and have a look, see what the context is. This one is a much easier question. It says, you're cute. I'm fat, I'm old. How to use joy of generosity and gratitude in meditation. Oh, this is easy one. Because there's 40 meditation objects, and some of those meditation objects are not what you take all the way into deep meditation. They get you started. Sometimes you have the recollections of the Buddha and Dhamma, the Sangha. That's why I know many Sri Lankans do that. When they start meditating, they start reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha. And because the Buddha means so much to them, ever since they were born, it's a very powerful recollection. But I really prefer the reflection on the goodness, what you've given in this world. Generosity is not just how much money you've donated to wherever. Generosity is just the kindness, the giving, not expecting anything back in return. You just go and help somebody. You look after them. You know, somebody comes along and they see I was coughing and they get me a nice cup of green tea. That's generosity. I don't like green tea. But I drank some, so you can get the full merit. So that's what the generosity is. And when you have that generosity, you feel, well, I gave the monk a cup of tea and then healed his throat. That should bliss you out. Don't underestimate that. And then you start meditating, wow, I've done something really good. I didn't have to do that. And I was the first to do it, and he actually drank some, even though he doesn't usually take green tea. That should make you so happy. I mean, that blisses you out if you can let it happen. And sometimes you just remember some of the things I used to do for Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah, a really great monk. And I could actually just wash his robe for him or something. Wow. You remember that? That brings you so much energy up and just it's so easy to meditate after that. Whatever great kindness you've done, not just to monks, just maybe to your mother or something, getting very sick and you sit by her bedside and hold her hand when you should be doing something else. You haven't slept all night, but you do it anyway. One of the examples of that was, in Bodhinyana Monastery, some people do sew their own robes. Mostly we get them from the cupboard, already pre-sewn. But in Thailand, when we ordained as monks, we had to make our own robes out of white cloth to sew them, had to wash them in detergent first of all to get the oil out, and then we had to make the dye out of the jackfruit wood, and that just took so long. You had to get the water out of the well, make a fire, you know, boil the water, put in the chips of jackfruit tree, the wood, and get the sap out of them, then concentrate the sap, and then put it on the white robe and beat it with your own hands until enough of that dye went into the robe, then hang it up to dry. You had to keep on turning it so the dye never streaked, and do that 3 or 4 times. It was really hard work. And so there's 3 monks were ordaining, so they had to make their own robes, a triple robe of the outer robe, an under robe, and a sangati, double layer. And it was taking them forever to do that, even though they were working really hard, non-stop. They'd been without sleep for 2 nights already, working all during the day and at night time as well. And after, I know what it's like when you haven't slept for 2 nights in a row, you feel just terrible. But you know, the rule was they had to carry on and finish the job. They weren't allowed to be helped. And I say I'm rebellious. So after the evening chanting, I went to the dyeing shed and I said, look, you know, you guys must be so tired. And they were. And I said, look, I'll take over tonight. Don't tell anybody, even though I'm breaking the rule. Please, I'll take over and you have a nice evening sleep. We come up before the 3 o'clock bell, because at 3:30 we started our morning chanting. They never argued. They were off. And so I did it. I had lots of energy. I just worked all night. And at 3 o'clock, they came and said, thank you, thank you. Just a few hours sleep was all they really needed to, you know, feel much better. And so then afterwards, I just went to the morning meeting. Meditation was so perfect, no sloth and torpor at all. And the chanting, you know, the chanting we do, you know, yo so bhaga. That morning it was, yo so bhagawa. I just, so much energy, I couldn't stop. But I was shouting the chant, honestly. And then afterwards we swept up, cleaned up, and then we went on our arms round. And during the arms round, there's no tiredness at all. I hadn't slept all night, worked hard. And I remember on the way back from the arms round, I asked the senior monk, what's happening? I said, I can confess, I helped these monks last night because they were so tired. And I didn't sleep at all yesterday. And I got so much energy. How come? That's not scientific. If you work really hard, you know, you should have no energy left. And he said, it's because you helped somebody. Compassion, not expecting anything back in return, boosts your inner energies. I know that, it's true. It's amazing just how much energy you can get from inside yourself for doing something beautiful for something else, somebody else. And that was just no physical energy. Mental energy was also really good. No sloth and torpor that morning. So if you understand that, please see the kitchen managers and volunteer for some more assistance. Is that correct, Nolia? Good, yeah. Because look, if you're not having good meditation, you've got too much sloth and torpor, that's how to fix it. Volunteer to do some selfless service, and I mean that. Next question, why is right view called that? Because it's not left view, so it has to be right view. It's right in the context that it leads to Nibbana. It's wrong view if you want to, say, win a football match or something. And the reason I say that is because when I first came here, I did think, you know, to get some more contact with the people of other places, other religions and spiritual paths, why don't we form a Buddhist football team? But then it would have to be played by Buddhist principles. Number one, let go. Compassion. So if the other team wanted the ball, you'd give it to them. And you don't never want to upset people. If they can't score a goal, you score a goal for them. an own goal. So I realised a Buddhist football team would not work. And that's why, you know, Buddhist countries, Thailand. Did you ever see Thailand going in World Cup soccer? No, they're all Buddhists. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if I experience sloth and torpor, even though with enough sleep, what can I do to tackle this? I realise when push press on with the sloth and torpor, I'd eventually gain energy and attention. Is this the right way? The way? Yeah, it is the way. Don't fight it. Sloth and torpor, if you've had enough sleep, is telling you you haven't had enough sleep. You're still tired. You should know the difference between the sloth and torpor and the boredom. If you have boredom, of course, you know, that means you should come and listen to the talk. And you see the talk, I always tell a few funny stories. I raise my voice every now and again, which means it's very difficult to fall asleep and get bored. You never know what I'm going to say, but I don't know what I'm going to say next. I never get bored when I give talks. So what that means, and also, just don't do the same old thing all the time. You know, sometimes people say, I do breath meditation, it's boring. Make it interesting. So what I did to make it interesting, I did what I call backwards breath meditation. Innovate. What backwards breath meditation is, look, I'm wasting time, doesn't matter. I've got another 5 or 6 days to waste. Backwards breath meditation. Now, those who want to prove this for themselves, close your eyes and just watch 3 breaths, in, out, and then open your eyes. Just watch 3 breaths. Just 3. And I guarantee that you watch the in-breath first and then the out-breath. Now, backwards breath meditation. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and watch 3 more breaths, but this time start with the out-breath. Out and then in. Out and then in. Out and then in for 3 cycles. Okay, try that. And open your eyes. It should be the same. It's just breathing, for goodness sake. But it feels different. That's called backwards breath meditation. What that does to you, it just shows you just how you can mess around with your perceptions. There's also the 3 in-breaths to the 1 out-breath meditation. You can see it makes it interesting. You're playing around a bit, but that is fine. If you're doing walking meditation... No, it's okay, I won't do this to you. We do... Well, I think I mentioned this to you already, didn't I? The Australian version of walking meditation? Kangaroo walking meditation. You start at one end, and you pull your hands like this, your feet together. You don't walk left foot right, you hop. Hop. Till you get to the end of the path. Seriously, try that. That, and do it seriously. Don't just, you know, just hop and then do something else. From one end to the other, kangaroo walking meditation. That will overcome your sloth and torpor. It brings some energy into your what you're doing it slightly differently. And then you'll find that the sloth and torpor disappears. The reason I looked at the nuns, because maybe I'm misogynistic, but I remember just asking the junior nun to please demonstrate the kangaroo walking meditation. I think, you've done that before, haven't you, Jyotika? No, I'm not going to ask you. I'm too kind these days. Unless you really want to. Sorry? Sorry?
Do you want to? No.
How about an anagarika?
No, okay.
But anyhow, it's just doing things slightly different. Even meditating in a different position. Instead of sitting that way, turn around and face the other way. It just makes it just more alive when you're meditating. And that means you can overcome the sloth and torpor. But it usually goes anyway. So when you're just relaxed and rested, you're enjoying the meditation, sloth and torpor vanish. So there's many things you can try there. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how this universe began? How is it going to end? Did Buddha told about it? Please explain. Live in the present moment. No, the Buddha said those are not useful questions. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between nimitta, jhana, 3-4 steps before enlightenment? Nimitta is when you first get to know the mind, experience the mind. 5 senses have disappeared, or they're disappearing, and the mind sense is dominant, and it appears like this nimitta. The jhana are going deeper than there, right in the middle of the nimitta. That's how you enter the jhanas. And in those jhanas, there is no real 5 senses. They've disappeared, and they're distant from you. So you can't hear, smell, taste, touch. And the steps before enlightenment, there is the steps of streamlining, once returning, non-returning, and then full enlightenment. Easy. Well, what do you want to know for? Will you remember that? When you experience it, then you remember it. Dear Ajahn, I have been so inspired by still flowing water. Will there be a similar version for Ajahn Brahm? I've got to die first, because that is a biography of Ajahn Chah and lots of his teachings. So I'm not dead yet. Are you trying to get rid of me? Dear Ajahn Brahm, would you please give us guided meditation instructions? I just did. Breathe in and out 3 times and then do backwards breath meditation. So I guided you. Look, seriously, guided meditations, they work for some people, they don't work for others. That's one of the reasons we don't give guided meditations here, because people come to listen to a talk or they come in here just to meditate quietly. So if you want a guided meditation, many of you got your iPhones or other devices, download one from the BSWA website, they're all for free. And then when you're in your cottage, in your room, you can plug it in and just listen to it in there. And you can do your meditation in there, guided by your favorite Ajahn Brahm or other people, guided meditation. That's the way to do it. Because if I do that for everybody, it's almost forcing everybody to follow a guided meditation. And it's not the right time for them. But you can choose yourself. And if you got your earplugs or whatever it's called, and then when you're doing that guided meditation in your room, it's comfortable and you can do it as much or as little as you want. So the guided meditations in your own room, download the guided meditations from the website. Next one. With noble silence, international dialogue stopped. International, must be intentional, I suppose. However, domestic inner dialogue increase. Is this normal and can you please advise? International dialogue stopped. I haven't got a clue what you mean. However, domestic inner dialogue increased. I think maybe you mean like talking with other people stopped, but your own sort of inner speech increase. Is this normal and can you please advise? Sometimes I think it may be that that's all you notice, the inner thoughts. But as I mentioned to somebody in the interviews, yes, you have inner thoughts, maybe still, but you also have lots of inner silence. What do I mean by that? Look in this room. What do you see in this room right now? Yeah, you see people, you see the monks, the nuns, you see the Buddha statue, the floor, the ceiling, the walls. Is that the biggest thing in this room? The biggest thing in this room is the space, the elephant in the room. Because we look for things, we don't notice the space between the things, which is greater than anything else. That's why if you start noticing the space in this room, it becomes really an interesting perception. It's actually not what separates people, but what binds people. And when you notice this space, there's so much space, you ask, why don't I notice that ever? Because somebody points it out, you can experience it. Same with the silence between those thoughts, which is far greater. But for many of you, you don't even look, you don't notice it. So you have an inner dialogue, but between those words, there's a lot of silence. The thing is, when you start to notice the silence, the spaces between those thoughts, it feels so much more beautiful, more profound, more, if you like, holy. And that means that you incline towards that more and more and more. You notice it first, and then it gets bigger and longer. You have much more fun.
Next question, funny one.
Do you think you could offer refugee status to me? I don't want to go home. Thank you. I can do something very close. I can give you the three refuges
in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, but not refugee status. Very good.
But it's true that sometimes you just really enjoy this meditation. And this is like the closest you can get to heaven in the world. Nothing is asked of you. You may ask stupid questions, do I ever tell you off? Maybe I should, who did that? Of course you never tell anybody off. And everybody is welcomed. You've received kindness and love and acceptance, no matter who you are, no matter where you come from. And you get delicious food and kindness all the way. This is a sort of like a heavenly realm. In the old days when we used to sit on the floor, we'd only have like two chairs. And it was like the two-seater realm. That was a silly joke, but nevertheless, a few people got it off. Two-seater realm is one of the heavenly realms, okay? But now we've got so many chairs, it's the, I don't know how many seater realm. Okay, I better get going. Is energy healing possible? When I was a kid, I was taken to a saint in India to heal an infection in my foot. He prayed for 5 minutes, touched my feet and asked me to rest. I was completely healed when I woke up. Yeah, of course it's possible. That's why you see some amazing things. Okay, here's one of my stories. That there was this Chinese gentleman, he's an elderly patriarch of a big family, he's very rich. And so he was in Royal Perth Hospital in the ICU. He was dying. And his family just gave a call, they didn't know which Buddhist monk to ask, so they phoned Bodhinyana Monastery and I took the call, said, but can you come to the ICU? You know, my father is dying. And I'm a kind monk, so I dropped what I was doing and got to the ICU. And because, you know, you never know when a person's going to die, I rushed into the ICU My mistake was not asking the family what was going on. They were in the waiting room. I just went into the ICU, did my stuff, and he came out of the coma. And he was going to survive. It was like, you know, a little miracle. And I was so pleased with myself. You know, you'd got the guy from the jaws of death and out of them. And I went and told the family, so he's going to survive. And I thought they'd give me this big ang pao for the monastery. An ang pao is this red packet and they put money in it. They were, you know, pretty well healed. And because these were all big business people, they'd come from Taiwan and from Hong Kong and mainland China and all over that area, Singapore probably. But when I told them that he was going to survive, they were really angry at me. He said, look, we brought you in here to chant so you can have a peaceful death. We don't even expect him to get better again. We've taken days off work. They'd already, he hadn't died yet, but they'd already prepared a funeral, arranged it all, and said, now we have to cancel the funeral service because he hasn't died. And then we have to go home. We've lost lots of money in our businesses by not being in the office in overseas. And, you know, he's got better, but he's going to not last that long. Another 6 months or so, 9 months, we're going to have to come back again and go through this all over again. Thanks to you, Ajahn Brahm. I came back home and never got any donations out of that. I didn't mind. It was just a lovely thing to do. But yeah, sometimes it works. But I did learn something from that. Whenever I make a mistake, you never feel sort of guilty or ashamed. You learn from it. So now if any of you ask me for some chanting, I ask you, which type of chanting do you want? The die peaceful chant or the get better chant? So I don't do the wrong one next time. That's true, that happened. So it is possible. Sometimes karma gets in the way and you can't do much. But the mind has power. And if you have that sort of power and you had some really good meditation, you go zap, 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 zap. It works. Weird. Dear Ajahn, about evening allowables, oh my goodness, for dark chocolate, if there is still a small amount of milk, fruit or nuts in that dark chocolate, is it still evening allowable? Thank you. So when you chew it, if you can feel any nuts in it, spit them out. No. As long as only a small traces, there's no problem at all. You can just eat it. But if there's lots of milk in there, lots of, I don't know what else, nuts and fruit in there, the idea is, no, you can't. Then it's not called dark chocolate, is it? Well, the Buddha said, and many monks quote this, if it's called dark chocolate, not dark chocolate covered hazelnuts or whatever, but just dark chocolate, then it is dark chocolate, and it fits into that category, you can eat it. But don't worry so much. The reason I said, oh my goodness, is because when I was a Vinaya expert as a young monk, we spent so much time arguing about what you can put in your mouth in the afternoon or evening, and it just went on and on and on, and on and on, and on, and on, and on. Instead of actually asking why do you put it in your mouth in the evening or afternoon? Why? So if it's a good reason, then fine, put it in your mouth. If it's not a good reason, then just don't. Dear Ajahn, what actually is calming? What's calming is, I imagine, I already mentioned, the water in my cup is moving all over the place because I picked it up. Now I put it down, it soon become very calm. No movement. Closer and closer to stillness. And stillness is the meaning for samadhi. And how do you do it? By letting go. This is one of Ajahn Chah's similes. He didn't have much water next to him, so he would actually pick up his hand. This was his visual method. So he would wave his hand like this. And he would say, this represents a leaf on a tree or a leaf on a bush. And it's moving because of the wind. Once the wind stops, the leaf will continue to move. But because of the friction with the air, it will move less and less and less, until after a time it will become perfectly still. That's its natural state, stillness. It only moves because the wind is blowing. And he said, that's like the human mind. Its natural state is stillness. That's a powerful statement, Ajahn Chah said. That's its natural state, tamachat. He said it only moves because of the winds of wanting something. If you want something, your mind will never be still. Once you stop wanting, you'll notice your mind is still moving, still thoughts coming in, still activities, but it moves less and less and less, and less and less, until it becomes perfectly still. That is the natural default state of the mind. That's why I keep saying that meditation is easy. It's a natural state of the mind, stillness. If you stop doing things, you just stop, you don't do stuff, your mind becomes still. It's nature, nothing to do with you. You don't hold it still. You let it be still by protecting it from the winds of wanting. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for the retreat and the wonderful experience it brings. We've only just started. It's only 2 or 3 days and you're already saying thank you. You must have already been enlightened. My sister's husband ended his life with a gun. Oops, I shouldn't have said that, should I? With a gun last night. I'm chanting metta for my sister and dedication merit to her husband. Is there anything else I can do? Sister's husband ended his life with a gun last night. So that's obviously bad news. Sometimes I feel a bit guilty when I tell a joke and then this happens afterwards. But what you can do is, first of all, why he ended his life. Sometimes no one can know. A person commits suicide and no one really knows the reasons for it. Only the person who committed suicide knows those reasons. But one thing I can say as a monk, just because they ended their life in a violent way like that, it doesn't mean they can't get good rebirths. I know that this happened some years ago, during the rains retreat a few years ago, I got the call that one of the Sri Lankan families here, they woke up in the morning and they found their 17-year-old son hanging on the end of a rope on the veranda. He committed suicide that night. Imagine how hard that is. It's almost impossible to imagine. But then another monk they know said, oh, that's bad karma. Your son will go straight to hell by committing suicide. Oh, my goodness. I thought, I don't know who that monk is, but that monk doesn't know what he's talking about. So they came to see me. And his brother, who's younger than him, wasn't speaking at all. He was still in real deep shock. And the father and mother were really shocked. And that was just like adding salt into the wound and turning the knife. Your son, which they loved, are dealing with the shock that he committed suicide. And some silly monk said he's going to go to hell now. And so I had to convince him otherwise. I asked him about your son. Was he a good kid? He was a wonderful kid. He never argued with his parents. He was doing well at school, had a girlfriend. Everything was going well in his life. There's no signs he was any distress. And being 17-year-old, you know, in a couple of months' time, he would do his university entrance exams. But he wasn't stressed out about that. He was doing well. But I used that information. I just asked the father, how many exams do you do? Or how many subjects do you do for university entrance? He said maybe five subjects. How many exams in each subject? Maybe 2 papers in each subject, that's 10 exams you'd have to sit. How many questions in each paper, average? Maybe 8 in each paper. We just use that as an approximation. So there's 80 questions he would have to answer to get into university. What would happen if the first 79 questions of those 5 subjects, 10 papers, what would happen if the first 79 questions were perfectly answered and the last question he messed up and stuffed up big time? You've only got 79 out of 80. Would he gain entrance to university? Pretty good score, isn't it? 79 out of 80. That's now almost 98 point something percent. Yeah, of course you get entrance to university. So your son, he answered so many questions in his 17 years of life perfectly. And you think just one mistake at the end of his life is going to send him to hell? And everything else he did doesn't count at all? Say, no way. You're not measured by the last thing you do in your life. You're measured by the whole of your life, by all the questions you answered correctly. And that was an explanation they could understand and they could accept. It was reasonable, logical. When I said that the brother started talking again. He wasn't so afraid, it worked. So he never encouraged suicide, obviously, but that was the case. It was overemphasized. You never judge a person by one act. They did. And they did thousands, millions of other acts. So that's one thing you can do to your sister's husband. If ever she thinks, oh, he's going to go to hell for that, no way. It's just you don't judge him by that act. You judge him by all the other wonderful things he did in his life. And we can do chanting for the husband. I don't know why he did that, but sometimes that when people judge themselves or judge their life, they feel failures, they feel ashamed, they've got no one to talk to, and they feel they've let other people down. You don't let other people down. You make a mistake, you're ruined or whatever it is, you can get up and do it again. Look at me. I was ruined when I was 23. I lost all my money. I gave it away to become a monk. I lost my girlfriend, the one girl I loved in life, when I was 19, I think. I was so happy. I could now become a monk. So you can always see the good side in whatever happens to you. Dear Ajahn, could you please ask the people wearing the puffer jackets to leave them outside the hall as a sound like giant, what's it, lolly papers, walking in? So it depends how warm or how cold it is, but you can always try to be quiet and be so mindful. As I said on the first night, you know, even in cold countries they have burglars and they must be wearing the puffer jackets as well. No one hears them. So try and walk so silently there's no sound at all. And if there is a sound, please remember it out of kindness that people are trying to keep warm. And when you have the kindness there, like that person who was breathing in loudly and breathing out loudly, when you realize what was going on, the kindness was strong enough to overpower any bad feelings about noise. And if you are ever meditating and the place is noisy, one method which I advise, I practice myself, I remember just testing myself out many times. One time, for those here in Perth, there was the Burmese community were having a kind of a protest or demonstration about the antics of the military government in Burma, in Myanmar. And so all we were doing, they had some photos of what was happening and inviting people to sit down meditating for a couple of hours. It was on the pavement, no cushions, and in the middle of the city opposite Hay Street Mall. And in those days, I always met, they said, do you want to come, Ajahn Brahm? We'll do a 2-hour meditation. Oh yeah, I'm into that. So we went there, sitting on the cold pavement. What I didn't realise, that the traffic wasn't noisy, but we were opposite this shop called Time Zone. And Time Zone had these computer games, and they were just belting out this music, which I didn't like, and really loudly in the middle of the city. And I thought, wow, this is really good. It's a very noisy place. Can I do some meditation here? And what I did was I just imagined a bubble around myself. And in that bubble, that was my space. And just the noise was outside. So you could kind of hear the noise, but it never really disturbed you. And that sort of imagination, visualization worked for me. So people can make all the noise they wanted. And I was peaceful inside. I remember doing that in the arrival hall at Suvarnabhumi Airport, and people coming backwards and forwards, making lots of noise, and just being able to meditate for an hour, and the noise never disturbed me at all. So even here, imagine the bubble around you when people walk in, and then the noise never disturbs you. What really disturbs you is not the noise of the puffer jackets, but the noise of your reaction afterwards. That guy wearing the puffer jacket, they should know better than that. I'm going to talk to Ajahn Brahm afterwards. I'm going to write a question about that. They shouldn't allow puffer jackets over in this. We should have better air conditioning. We should make sure that no puffer jackets happen at all. I don't know who that is, but they should be blacklisted. We should have a retreat where no puffer jackets are allowed for anywhere, any place. We should maybe just have other jackets other than puffer jackets. The guy has sat down, is probably in jhana many minutes ago, but you're still thinking about it. That's the noise, the reaction. But anyway, those with puffer jackets, please try and be quiet. How to be less of a control freak? It is a habit forged out of trauma and fear. It's the answer to send more metta to myself. Thank you. Send metta to yourself, send metta to all the people around you as well. And then you realize you're totally safe. This place is one of the safest places in the world, in Jhana Grove. You know, the quality of people here, you're very high-minded people. You keep precepts, for goodness sake. And you're kind to one another. So, probably the safest group of people in the whole world are in here right now. And so you can relax. And it's important we keep those precepts of non-harming one another. We do that because then when you do feel safe, you can let go of all your these five senses. You don't need to keep an ear out. Is someone going to hurt me? Is someone going to take me? Is someone going to steal my puffer jacket because they don't like me coming in here? Which means you can let go. It's important for meditation you feel safe. When you feel safe, you don't have to be a control freak. You can trust each other. Dear Ajahn, thank you for teachings and for being here. Everyone has to be somewhere, I just happen to be here. I've been finding it difficult to switch gears, even before the retreat in regular daily meditation. Trying to let go, as I usually do, gets overpowered by defilements, mainly work stuff. I try to remind myself that a spiritual life is more important, but my mind regularly ruminates on unwholesome things. Any tips? This is only, again, the second full day at Jhana Grove, so give it time. After a while, you feel really safe here and you enjoy it, and it gives them more value. You can feel the value of this spiritual life. And you don't do the switching of the gears. The switching of the gears happens naturally. If you do something, you usually mess it up. Instead, just stay here and just experience the peace and the quiet, and experience the thinking in the mind and the defilements. And after a while, you'll notice automatically the mind will incline towards the peace and the joy and the happiness. You don't do meditation. Meditation just grows on you. And you find yourself being more peaceful and valuing. the peace and the stillness and the wisdom and the intuition more and more and more, and it's effortless. You don't switch gears, the gears switch themselves. Okay, it's 8:37, do another couple of minutes, or have you had enough? I think you've had enough, you're not even answering. You're all zonked out. Okay, one more. Techniques to quiet the mind. Could you share a few of your favorite techniques to quiet the mind? Some years ago you have mentioned a simple technique where you repeat Namo Tassa so as to diffuse the oncoming thoughts. Okay, yeah. That is just using mantras. So you've got lots of thoughts in your mind and they're going crazy. So you substitute your thought, like Namo Tassa, Bhagavato. Actually, just Namo Tassa, that's enough. And you do that. Do you know what that means? If you know what it means, it starts you thinking again. So use some meaningless chant. It does have a meaning, but you probably are not expert in Pali, you don't know what it means. That's much better. So you keep saying to yourself, Namo Tassa, Namo Tassa. It sounds easy enough, you can remember that. So you keep repeating it, maybe about 10 or 15 times, Namo Tassa, Namo Tassa, as slowly as you can. And then, once you've done that, and that is sort of pretty constant inside of you, and it keeps the other thoughts out, then you extend the gaps between the vowels. Instead of Namo Tassa, Namo Tassa, Na. Mo, ta, sa. And then, after another 10 times of doing that, you extend the gaps even more. Na, mo, ta, sa. And if the thoughts come in there, you've expanded the gaps too quickly. Close them up. And then you get to the point where you're so quiet, na, Mo ta sa. The spaces are just so long because you enjoy them and you find all those train of thoughts has disappeared. That was the method I think you're talking about. If thoughts come in, close up the gaps. It's like a gradually turning towards the silence rather than the thoughts. Okay, there is a few questions left, as usual, but that's our tradition now, so I'm not breaking the old tradition. There's only a few questions left. So thank you all for listening, and I hope it worked out okay for you. And if you don't mind, that for the husband of your sister, I'm going to do a little chant for them, if I might. They shot themselves. Yata wali waha pura pari parenti sagarang ewa mewa ito dinang peta nangu pakapati ichitang patitang tum hankipa mewa samichatu sabbe parentu sankapa chando panalazo yata mani jodirazo yata. That's for the person who passed away. So may our merits go to them and may they everything work out peacefully in their relations, lives, and may it be an example for us to care for each other. These things happen, you can't stop it now, it's happened, to let it go and make peace, and be kind and be gentle. Thank you.